Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
Yep. And NPR.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today's show actually started with a conversation that we had working on another show.
Which was on words.
Paper. Eagle. Clock. Green. Barrel. Cat. Alligator. Hat. Cardinal. Door. Door. Door.
So yeah, we did an hour on the power of words, and we ended up talking with this guy.
Hello.
Hello, is this Dr. Fernyhough?
Hi, can you hear me now?
Named Charles Fernyhough.
I'm a writer and developmental psychologist from Durham University.
And we were having this conversation with him about what happens to young kids when they learn words.
Orange juice. Apple. DJ. Thinking.
Like that, you know, like what happens to the way they see the world. And in the middle of the chat, he said something kind of radical, which was that before they have words...
I don't think very young children do think.
Like think, period? Was there a period at the end of that sentence? You don't think that they think, period?
I don't think they think in the way that I want to call thinking, all right? Which is a bit of a cheat, but let me say...
What he meant is that thinking, as he defines it, is basically just words sounding silently in your head. And before you have those words in your head, you can't think. This is a controversial idea, which we debated back and forth. But for the next few minutes, we're not going to debate it. We're going to jump into it.
But before we do that, let's just announce the topic of the entire hour.
Okay, tell them.
The voices in our heads. I don't know if it's plural or singular. Voices in our head. I think my head.
No, heads is heads. Worse, yeah.
Okay.
We're going to dive into inner voices is the point. The voices that shape who we are.
That help us through tough times.
Maybe even do us harm.
As a starting point, we're going to take very seriously what Charles Fernyhough just suggested, that before kids have language, they just don't think.
Because whether or not you think it's true, if you follow the idea all the way through, as we're about to do, it does lead you to some interesting places. So, first of all, this whole idea, says Charles, goes back to this Russian guy.
Russian psychologist, Vygotsky.
Lev Vygotsky.
Yeah.
And is he a contemporary dude?
No, he died in the 30s. He was active in
Anyhow, he came up with this idea. It's a really interesting notion of how kids learn to think. And it all begins, he said, on the outside.
Think about a small child who's sitting down solving a puzzle.
Marco, does that look like it goes somewhere?
It goes... here.
You're sitting down and you're working together on a puzzle, and all you've got to do is get these shapes into this board in the right kind of order. If you watch any kid in it with their parent anywhere in the world doing this kind of thing, you'll see them thinking together.
No, that doesn't have an edge.
The child, for example, picks up a picture of a boat and says, you know, where am I going to put this boat piece? And then the mum says, well, have a look at the shape.
Stella.
And then the kid looks at the shape and says, oh, it's got that pointy bit there. And the mum says, right, well, can you see anywhere on the board that has a pointy bit?
Right there.
And so on.
According to Vygotsky, this is the beginning of thinking, this kind of dialogue. And at this point...
it's completely external.
It's all happening in that space between the child and her mother.
Try putting that together. We don't know where it goes yet, but if you put it together...
and only over time does it become internalized.
And how that happens, Vygotsky thought, is that as the child gets older, she'll start to take on the dialogue herself. She'll start to talk to herself.
This is the stage we call private speech.
We've all seen kids do this, right? Where they narrate every single thing they're doing. Put the ball in the box. Take the ball out of the box.
Now, what then happens is a few years further down the line.
These kids who are narrating everything they're doing then go to school, and the teachers tell them, shh, don't talk out loud.
So they kind of get the message that they need to start doing this internally.
So they start to whisper to themselves out loud, and then eventually they whisper to themselves silently. Because the words are now in their head. And that,
according to Vygotsky's theory, that is thinking.
Only then, he says, is the child having a thought. Now, forgetting the particulars for a second, the main point here is that those thoughts that are humming along silently in your mind, those thoughts began as a duo with your mom, or a trio with your mom and your dad, or a quartet with your mom and your dad and your sister. In other words, those thoughts began as a crowd.
The logic of it is that all our thinking is full of other people's voices.
Now, most of us know that the voices in our head are just us. But what got us interested in this whole Vygotsky thing is that maybe this idea has something to say to people who actually do hear other voices in their head.
Yeah, Molly.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
You too. Thanks for coming up here.
Yeah.
As we were thinking about this, it just so happened that our producer, Pat Walters, had taken a trip to Denver and ended up tracking down this lady.
And I'm Molly Martin, and I am a psychotherapist, and I run the Hearing Voices Network of Denver.
They met up at this hotel. Molly works with people who hear voices in their heads, and she runs a support group for people to share their experiences. The day Pat was there, she introduced him to a fellow named Marcus.
Hi, I'm Marcus Macias. I'm a voice hearer myself. I hear voices. So, you know, I first started hearing them 20 years ago. So I'm 40 now. So it was when I was 20 when I first started hearing them.
When it started for him, he says, the voices would kind of materialize out of background noise, like the hum of a refrigerator or the whir of a fan.
When I first started hearing them, they were kind of guiding a little bit, you know, like guiding voices. Like
he says initially the voices would help him out, like if he was in an argument and about to say something mean. The voices would warn him.
Be careful, watch out. They'd say things like that, you know, kind of like they're helpful. But then there was like other negative ones.
He's had periods in his life, he says, where the voices have even turned demonic.
Things are a lot better now, though. See, I'm learning how to manage them, you know, because I'm taking care of myself, you know, so.
Okay, so why do we bring this up? Well, clearly for a lot of people like Marcus, hearing voices involves some psychiatric issues, which sometimes for people can be serious, really serious. But here's the weird thing. The experience of hearing somebody else's voice in your own head is actually way more common than you would think. Surveys have been done about this, and the number seems to be between 5 and 10% of normal, healthy people have that experience or have had it at one time. Which brings us back to this Vygotsky situation. What might be happening in those cases, at least if you ask Charles, is a kind of misattribution of your own inner voice. Those voices in your head, which are you, get mistaken to be from someone else.
A nice, simple, elegant demonstration of this is that you take some people who are hearing voices, people with, in this case, a diagnosis of schizophrenia, who hear voices, and you sit them down at a microphone with some headphones on, and you show them some words on a screen. Just flash up some words on a screen, and their task is to repeat the words, to read the words out loud.
Now, if you can imagine, these subjects are seeing these words on the screen. They're repeating them into the mic, and they've got headphones on, so they're actually hearing their own voices as they're doing this. Trick is, the researchers have rigged it so that the voice in their headphones, their voice, actually gets lowered just a little bit right before they hear it. What that means is that if I were to say, hello, my name is Jad, what I'd hear in my headphones is,
hello, my name is Jad.
And as you know, if you lower the pitch of the voice by a few semitones, it becomes much harder to recognize it.
Because when I'm speaking in this lowered voice, you can still kind of recognize it's me, but it's a little bit harder.
Now, what the experimenters found is that most people, most non-voice hearing, quote-unquote healthy people, when they were presented with the sound of their own voice
lowered, like this, and then asked, is this you, is it a stranger, or are you not sure, they did make mistakes. Some mistakes.
The voice hearers made considerably more mistakes.
Really?
Yeah.
Not only that, when they heard their voices lowered, they would very, very often say, that voice is coming from a stranger.
That's not me. That's not myself. That didn't come from me. Now, of course, that is potentially a frightening experience. That's potentially a very distressing experience.
But not always. Because let's just imagine Vygotsky was right, that the internal voice of our thoughts is actually a blend of all of those external voices from our childhood. So in other words, our mom, our dad, our sisters, brothers, whatever, they're all in there in some way. And that can actually be a comfort. Back at that hotel in Denver, Molly Martin had told Pat
about a woman
who had seen her father murdered.
He was shot in front of her. It was a robbery. And it was, I believe, at a convenience store.
And for years afterwards, she says, this woman would hear her dad's voice.
Every morning, when she would wake up, he would tell her to make her bed. And he would remind her throughout the day to do more positive things. And if she was doing something, for example, she was a drug addict, and if she wanted to use drugs again, her father would say to her things like, you know, don't do it, you know, it's bad for you. You know, more looking after her. I think she might have been 11 when he was killed, but it was a good relationship during that time.
Yeah, and then it just kind of like stuck, like frozen.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
You know, that story is because it's some foreign voice in our heads. That's a little unusual. I mean, most of us are very familiar with an inner thought where it's yourself doing the talking, so you're listening to your own voice.
Right.
Lord knows I have that experience constantly. sometimes the voices are helpful. Sometimes, as we're about to hear, they can be up to some kind of mischief.
Right. That's actually what our next story is all about. And this one goes back to a psychology professor named Claude Steele.
I got a job offer, this is in the 80s, at the University of Michigan, and it was part psychology and part to administer a minority student program there. And in the process, I saw data that surprised me.
What he saw was a troubling trend. Two kids would enter Michigan. One was black, one was white. They'd come in at the exact same levels.
Same skills, same SAT score.
So theoretically, they should do the same when they get to Michigan. But without fail, or almost without fail, after one semester,
the black kid was winding up with lower grades.
How much lower?
Pretty dramatic. At least 2/3 of the letter grades.
Meaning if the white kid got an A, the black kid, who should be getting an A too, is instead getting a B.
That's right.
Or a B plus. That's significant.
That's significant.
And he also, by the way, saw this performance gap between women and men when it came to math. To the same degree?
The same degree. In advanced math courses, it was comparable. I learned this is a national phenomenon. If I was to walk into almost any college class in the United States, I'd have a very high probability of finding exactly that.
What could explain these differences?
There was something there that people didn't understand and that we certainly didn't understand.
So he figured he would start with the woman in math issue. He brought a bunch of women in and a bunch of men. Sophomores.
Brought them into the laboratory one at a time, gave them a half an hour section of the graduate record exam you take if you're a math major. Very, very difficult math.
Mm.
And sure enough, the women who had all the same credentials coming into that situation performed dramatically worse than the men.
Worse as in?
It'd be a couple hundred points on an SAT test.
Big difference.
So this was a big effect.
So Claude Steele thought, all right, step one complete. I've got a lab situation that resembles the real world. Good. Now the next step is to tweak things a little bit, see if I can mess around with it. Now, normally in these situations,
the test giver's got a white lab coat on and he brings in a big stack of cellophane wrapped tests and he puts a clock on the table. It's it's going to intimidate almost anybody.
Maybe that's what's happening, he thought. What if I took away the clock, took away the coat, and most importantly, right before the test, I had the test giver, instead of saying the normal, I'm going to give you a test, pre-test thing, maybe instead say something like this.
Look, you may have heard that women don't do as well as men on difficult standardized math tests. You may have heard that, but that is not true for this particular test.
Oh.
This particular test does not show gender differences, never has, never will.
He wondered if maybe saying that simple sentence before giving the test would have an effect.
And sure enough, I wouldn't be here if their performance didn't go up to match that of the equally skilled men.
That performance gap totally vanished.
Gee, look at this thing. So we raced and did it very quickly, the same kind of an experiment with African Americans.
There, the pre-test disclaimer went like this.
This is an instrument that we use to study problem solving, and it is not diagnostic of individuals' intellectual ability.
In other words, this is not a test of your intelligence. I repeat, not an IQ test.
So just do the best you can.
And with that simple disclaimer at the start,
same kind of an effect.
The black students and the white students were now equal.
Just recently, Ryan Brown and Eric Day did an even cleverer treatment. There is an IQ test which is nonverbal.
It's called the Advanced Progressive Matrices.
It has figures.
Very abstract. They got lines crossing.
That you have checker, to match and so on.
Checks.
It's essentially pattern matching.
Diamonds with dots in them.
Totally visual.
Yeah, and so they could represent that test as it is, as an IQ test. It's in fact seen as the gold standard of IQ tests because it's, quote, culture free.
There's no math. There's no reading.
Because it doesn't involve language. Or you could represent the exact same test as a puzzle.
Puzzle.
Meaning you can give an IQ test to a bunch of kids and the blacks will perform worse. But if you give that same test, lose the word IQ, and just call it a puzzle,
the black participants suddenly jump up in their performance.
Basically, we got a reversal.
When you represent it as a puzzle, blacks perform as well as whites.
They did, yeah.
That's all it takes. Just change a few words.
In fact, there's even better research on this by a guy named Jeff Stone at University of Arizona, who's shown this with golfing tasks, where he's had black and white golfers just putt.
With
so this,
putting?
This can even,
we're
yes,
talking about
even
putting?
Think about what it takes to putt effectively. Are you a golfer?
No.
Ryan's not either, so he doesn't know what he's talking
about. That's right,
about.
So I'm going to make this up. You have to concentrate.
What we did was we got a miniature golf situation where each hole changed and people had to work around obstacles.
This is Jeff Stone. He runs the Social Psychology of Sports Lab at the University of Arizona. And here's what he did. He tested his black and white putters in two scenarios. Scenario one, using the word intelligence.
When we told him it was a measure of sports intelligence, black participants did about 4 strokes worse than white participants.
But when he changed it, took out the word intelligence and framed it instead as a test of your natural athletic ability, there, the results totally flipped.
And we had now whites performing significantly worse than blacks by about 4 strokes. If you look at the recent U.S. Open that was played in San Diego, Tiger Woods and Rocco Mediate went 4 days, 18 holes. They went to an 18-hole playoff on Monday.
Yes!
Oh! And we're still tied.
Sudden death we go.
And Tiger finally won it on the first playoff hole.
Tiger Woods wins a third U.S. Open championship.
By 1 stroke. So when you talk about 4 strokes, that's a huge difference.
All right, so here's my question. Stereotypes are powerful. Okay, that makes sense. Now, but in terms of understanding how this works, can you make this tactile for me? Like if the stereotype that's having all these effects is like a thing, like a like a little gremlin that bites, like when in the test-taking process does it actually like do its damage?
That's going to be way open to debate.
What does seem to be clear from the data, according to Eric Day and Ryan Brown and Claude Steele, is that the gremlin only seems to appear when the test is sufficiently hard.
If the test is easy, it's important to point out, these effects don't happen.
It's not that the gremlin is not there.
Well, he walks in with you, but he doesn't speak necessarily until things get challenging.
As soon as the test gets difficult,
that's where the voices kick in.
Which means that for most of the tests, everybody's doing about the same. It's only at problem number 17, the one about cosines and factorials and whatever, where things start to go wrong, and at least that's the theory. At that problem, the black student starts to stiffen up a little bit.
That's right.
And Claude Steele's measured this.
Their blood pressure is elevated, their short-term memory is impaired.
It's that flicker of frustration through their body that wakes up the gremlin who starts to whisper in their ear.
I don't know if you can do this.
Is what they say about us true?
They don't think you can do it.
All the usual stuff. And even if the student doesn't believe it, which is likely.
See, you don't have to believe it. That's the kind of insidious thing here.
Just the fact that he has now this extra bit of mental chatter.
That little guy whispering.
Well, it's a distraction.
And that makes their performance go down.
Just a little bit.
All of this dialogue is keeping you from being 100% focused on the task at hand, which is solving these problems.
So the real subtle power of a stereotype isn't that it prevents you from doing the thing you want to do. It distracts you for just a beat from doing the thing you want to do, and that may be all the difference.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Nick, and I'm from Minneapolis. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.